back to Classical Guitar Insider. This is your host, Brett Williams. And today on the show, it's guitarist Milos. He goes by his first name because his second name, he feels he doesn't want to, you know, be a pain in the butt. He doesn't want to have to make people do things that they don't want to do. But I want to do it. I'm going to give it a shot. Let's see. Karadoglic. Did I do it right? Milos Karadoglic? And it's not Milos. It's Milos Karadoglic. You know, it's our responsibility as citizens to pronounce things correctly. I don't always do it, but I always give it a shot. This guy's a big name, huh? Big guy. He is on the Deutsches Grammophon label, which was big. It was a big moment. All of a sudden, you're like, there's a new guitarist, and he's on the Deutsches Grammophon. That's incredible. So, you know, I sort of like listened. I listened to maybe the first album, the second album. I sort of dropped off, and he started kind of doing his own thing. And, you know, I don't know. It was just one of those things where I sort of, his publicist reached out, and I was like, oh, this is cool. Yeah, I'd love to talk to him. But, you know, I was like, I don't know, what are we going to, you know, talk? And then I actually, you know, did the work and went in and listened to his latest album, which is a collection of works for guitar and orchestra by like some of the biggest names in film. Howard Shore. You know, it's that album is outstanding. It's an incredible performance, pure virtuosity, paired with the London Symphony Orchestra. It's just, it's these pieces he's commissioned, and the level at which these composers are writing for the guitar is unprecedented. It just doesn't exist. And it was one of my favorite albums of all time for the guitar. It was really exciting. And I'm back. I'm looking forward to what this guy's going to do for the instrument in the future. I'm a believer. In the Milos way. So, you know, then I got excited about interviewing her. It was exciting. You know, we ran into this problem that I had with Anna Vidovich. Got to do that right. Am I doing it right? The Zoom is starting to sort of just relax. I don't know what's going on there. If the pandemic's over and like at the Zoom offices, they're just sort of putting their feet up. They're taking summer Fridays on a Tuesday. Something's going on because it's not what it was. I'm having a hard time depending on the old Zoom. I got the kids sitting there freezing up. We had Milos freezing up. Milos was just like, we were having such a hard time. And he said he had a good connection. I looked at my connection. I was getting like 250 megabytes per second. I'm like, what's going on? It has to be Zoom. So anyway, we turned off the video just to sort of, I don't know, save bandwidth, as if bandwidth is an issue. It's just not. And we turned it off and we just did it without video. So I think this is, I think this is now going a little too far. I used to require all interviews to be in person. I was just not interested in doing a Zoom interview or anything like that. It wasn't even Zoom. Back before the pandemic, it was just FaceTime. And what is it? What's the one? The one that goes, what's that one called? It's got the little bubbly sound at the beginning. I don't even remember what it's called. You guys remember that? The thing before Zoom that's not Zoom? You guys are yelling at me right now. I'm not going to look it up. I don't got time for that. Anyway, Zoom's dropping the ball. I don't know what to do. Apple is also dropping the ball. It's like you can't listen to Logic with AirPods on anymore. And when you ask, it's just like the signal is just an awful, you know, thing. You can't, the signal's bad. And when you talk to Apple about it, they're like, yeah, you shouldn't use AirPods with Logic. And we're like, I'm like, dude, I used AirPods with all of the DAWs, no problem, for the last 15 years. It's not, I'm not just being irresponsible using your tool. Why is, dude, this world is just filled with greed. I got a landlord issue right now too. I gotta be honest. Remember how last time I was real excited about the apartment? Okay, so she doesn't want us to have guests after 10 o'clock at night. She lives right below us. She monitors who comes and goes. It's awful. You know? Screaming at Liz about like electricity bills the first day we're here as if we have anything to do with it. Like just, we found out we moved above a person like that. And she happens to own this apartment. So that's a bummer, and it's really the broker's fault. We asked the broker several times. We go, hey, this is kind of an elderly woman. Is she okay with us like having a dinner party? Oh, yeah, don't worry about it. She's great. I've known her for 30 years. Bullshit. Liar. Took our money. By the way, they make us look at this thing that says, I don't work for you. I work for the landlord, but you have to pay. This is a New York thing. It only happens in New York City. It's awful. We're just very disillusioned by the city right now, Liz and I are. It's sort of a weighing heavily on us. But, you know, what are you going to do? We have to move further out? We have to move next to a car dealership? Is that why I moved to New York City? I felt that way moving out of Manhattan. Remember when I was in Manhattan? I was like, why do we have to move out of Gotham? It's fun here. And then, you know, but nobody cool lives over there. No offense, but you know, it's just easier to make friends here. People are kind of doing, you know, we've already talked about this. So, but now it's like, dude, there's like literal, like just celebrities living here and the price is too high. We're getting pushed out of Greenpoint. It's what's happening. All right. So that's what's going on with me. Everything else. I mean, it's pretty good. I love the apartment. I just, you know, we're social people and we stay up late and, you know, we like to knock them back and chat. And that's a big no-no here. I know everybody's saying, just do it anyway, man. Don't worry. Yeah, you do that too. You know, I always thought I could kill a mouse. I can't kill a mouse. And I can't be mean to an old lady. Can't do it. It's not in me. I tried. I was like, I'm just going to give her a piece of my mind. And as soon as she, you know, comes out of her apartment and I hold the door open for her, I'm like, have a nice day. She's like, you too. And it's just, you know, yeah, that's me. Talk a big game. The show is sponsored by a very old friend of mine. I've known this guy for 20 years. Him and his wife, Laura Metcalf. Am I saying that right? I hope I am. Let me just look it up real quick. I think I am. They are the Boyd meets girl guitar cello duo. Wait, nothing happened. Let's try that again. Boyd meets girl. Cello. Yeah. Oh, wait, hold on a second. Did I say it? Yeah, Laura Metcalf. I was right. Okay, let's start that over. A really good friend of mine, Robert Boyd. Okay, not like a really good friend, but like a guy I've known for a long time. And we're very supportive of each other. And we're both New Yorkers, and we've both been, you know, in the game for the same amount of time. He was the second interview ever on this show, right? I'm very excited for him. I'm always excited when he comes out with something new. He's supporting the show. They are supporting the show. And their new album is Songs of Love and Despair. It's available on March 25th. It's going to be on Spotify, Apple Music, Amazon, etc., all the usual places. The album is a mix of works and arrangements for guitar and cello, including pieces by Debussy, Boccherini, and Messiaen, through to arrangements of Beyoncé, The Beatles, and Radiohead. How is this for a read? I'm a little tired today, huh? It's recorded at the Grammy Award-winning Sono Luminos Studios in Virginia. So an outstanding performance and outstanding audio quality mark this landmark performance. I'm going to play you guys a couple of seconds from their performance of Beezer's Mountain Songs. This is Movement 4, Hush You By. That was Beezer's Mountain Song Movement 4, as performed by the Boyd Meets Girl cello and guitar duo. Their new album, Songs of Love and Despair, is going to be out on March 25th. Make sure you check it out. And thank you for supporting the show, Rupert and Laura. The show is also sponsored by, as always, Richard Sage at savageclassical.com. That's S-A-V-A-G-E, classical.com. You can go there and you can pick out the guitar of your dreams. Just tell him I sent you. That's savageclassical.com. Right here in New York State. Also sponsored by rosettapodcast.com/insider. You can choose one language of your choice and only one for $9 a month. And you can just learn it until your face turns blue. Or you can go ahead and for $200, you can learn all the languages that Rosetta Stone has. I'm not sure if they have all the languages. I bet they don't. You know what? Don't go to rosettastone.com. Go to rosettapodcast.com/insider. That's rosettapodcast.com/insider to support the show and learn the language of your choice. All right, so let's get on with it. You can also have your project talked about during the intro. Make sure you go to brettwilliamsmusic.com, support or contact, and reach out to me about it, and we'll get you a little package, and we'll make it happen. Get the word out. All right, here's my time with Milos. Well, first of all, Milos, thanks a lot for coming on the show. I was just listening to your album of music by film composers a little bit before this in preparation for the interview, and it's outstanding. I don't know why I want to start there. It just seems like it's such a indicative sort of recording of your approach to the instrument and to sort of spreading the message of the guitar to, communities that are larger.
Well, that's very nice to hear. Thank you so much for that, Brett. Because for me, that album is very important for so many reasons. And that is that one of the main reasons really is that it's new music and that it's actually music that was commissioned and written for me and music that was composed by composers that I have admired and loved over the years. By being a fan of their other work. And also, what's very important is that, you know, guitar is quite a young instrument and it doesn't have such a huge wealth of concertos that are part of the standard repertoire. So it's always very meaningful and important when you can inspire composers to write that sort of repertoire for the guitar, because by having new pieces, you're expanding the outreach for the instrument and you are making it more of an equal on the international concert platform with great orchestras and so on. So having Howard and Joby write concertos to that extent, I mean, they wrote such monumental pieces, meant a lot, because it meant that I wasn't just doing what I was really passionate about doing, but I was also focused on what it meant in a sort of a global sense, and what it can do and achieve in terms of the guitar and its place in the world.
Yeah, and it really seems, I mean, especially the piece by Joby Talbot, it's called Ink Dark Moon, comes in seven movements. It's just so, usually when someone writes a guitar concerto for us or for you, it generally, especially a composer of that caliber, it's something that... It's generally not so much, I don't find like so much work goes into it. It certainly isn't something of a masterpiece, but this is something, this is really a serious piece of music. This is a masterpiece. It is, it's got all the color and meticulousness that you would ever hope for when someone's writing a piece for you. What was your relationship with him before? Is he a guitarist?
No, he isn't. No, he isn't, interestingly. But the fact was that the two of us are really good friends. And when we decided we were going to do this, we knew it was going to be a collaboration. So my role in it was always to say to Joby, please write me the piece that you want to write. I want to have a guitar concerto that has no compromises and no elements missing from what you ideally would write, just because you're writing it for the guitar. Leave the part of making it possible on the guitar to me. So I think that was a really, really good starting point, because it meant that Joby just, was working on all the vents of his creativity without restricting himself in any way, because it was a guitar concerto. And I think you're right to say that often when people are writing guitar concertos, they are sort of limited by what they perceive is possible or not possible on the instrument. And they always are limited by if the orchestra is going to be too big, or it's a very, it can be a very restrictive process unless you are very clear in your mind what you want it to be. Especially with the Talbot concerto, with Joby Ink Dark Moon, I felt that there was a lot of magical coincidences with this piece, because it was such an important moment for me and in my career, and, you know, doing it at the Proms and having it premiered there and so on. But at the same time, it was also important for me to get away from always being asked to play the Rodrigo Aranjuez.
Yes.
Because, I mean, it may absolutely make sense to go to an orchestra, to a big-named orchestra, and do the Aranjuez as your first sort of baptism of fire. But then there is always that question, what do we do next? And more than often, instead of doing another concerto in next season, the orchestra would wait for 5 or 6 seasons and then just program Aranjuez again. Mm-hmm. And what that does, it doesn't allow for progress. It doesn't allow for new ideas. It just means that we are constantly going back to what is an amazing piece of music. But that piece is already there. And I just felt so strongly that, and I continue doing it. I mean, I'm talking to composers now, and I think if I possibly could, I would have a new concerto premiered every season.
Yeah.
But it's such an important part of what we do, and I take that very seriously.
You said that you had a relationship with Joby before. I understand that you studied in London. Did you guys know each other through that scene, or how did you guys meet?
No. Not really. We met we have common friends because, you know, like in New York, in London, we all kind of know each other. It's a scene, and we were just introduced as friends. And when after a performance that I went to see of his, and I actually went to see the ballet, The Adventures of Alice in Wonderland, that is this beautiful choreography by Christopher Wheeldon. At Royal Ballet, and I just went for the ballet. I didn't go for the music because I didn't know Joby, know his music at that point. Mm-hmm. And when I heard it, I just thought it was the best new score I've heard in a very, very long time. So I ended up meeting Joby afterwards and talking about the concerto, and that's how our friendship and our professional relationship started in creating this new piece. BBC Symphony Orchestra was very quick to get on board with this piece and commission it for us. And it was just a real natural, because everything about that process was very, very easy and very natural.
The Inaudi is sort of the most popular piece on the album, and it's for good reason. It's an unbelievable piece. Could you tell me more about that composer and your relationship with him?
Yes, so on the album there are Shore and Talbot as two big world premiere concertos, but I just thought that it would be nice on the album to have two miniatures, as in like two afterthoughts and two encores, in a way that I would do them in a concert. So the Einaudi, I mean, he's probably one of the most streamed and listened composers in the world right now.
And of course I don't know him because
I mean it's extraordinary what this man does. I mean he writes one piece after another, and he has really almost a cult following. And it's absolutely unbelievable. But at the same time, it's completely a different sort of music and something that I naturally wouldn't be inclined towards for myself and for my own artistic journey. But actually it was my producer at Decca that just mentioned him, and she said, I just heard this piece of Einaudi, and I just thought that it's something that could work. Would you mind having a look? And I thought, you must be crazy. I mean, it's like, I don't think this will ever work, but let me try. And then the moment I put my fingers on the guitar trying to imagine this, I thought, wow, this really is a fantastic idea. So I went on to create the arrangement and so on. And I just thought, this is also really, really special. And it felt like such a natural fit with the Tollwood concerto because it had the same sort of nocturnal theme and this kind of filmic energy. The approach to music is so different depending on what you are preparing. And it's a completely different process of preparing the Aranjuez concerto, a solo recital, or a piece like the Shore concerto or the Tollwood, just because of the nature and the intrinsic energy behind those pieces. But for me, to work with composers who know how to write for film and for choreographies where there is a visual element feels very natural for one reason, and that is that when I'm learning any piece of music, I'm learning it in this very visual way. I always help my performance by creating these visual memories and images of the piece in my head, so that when I'm playing the piece live on stage, that I'm going from one scene to another. So in a way, I'm perhaps creating in my own head a film. And that just goes because of the kind of imagination and personality that I have, which tends to be much more visual and abstract than practical and didactic. And I find that helps me in my process so very much. So when these pieces were being written for me, I was given an opportunity to influence composers to write works that suit my approach and my playing and my imagination, mm-hmm. As in 100%, because they were conceived for what I do. And playing them now live on stage, each time just creates this unbelievable feeling for me. And I think the audience feels it too. I just need to have the orchestras be more brave about programming something that's not the Aranjuez, because the orchestras are still really concerned if they program something that's not a famous concerto, and that can be frustrating.
Yeah, that's sort of the thing. When you're looking at your career, you have sort of mixed in a lot of pieces that are standard repertoire, and then you're just at sort of not random points, but there are these, and then you throw in things like your last album, your last solo album in 2019, you have The Sound of Silence, right? Which you obviously probably have like a connection with that song, otherwise you wouldn't have, you know, made it the title track of your album. But then there's a piece by, you know, that involves Assad, you know, arranged by Assad and Metcalf and all these other sort of things. So you seem to kind of go in between playing pieces, the pieces that you're talking about, pieces, you know, akin to the Aranjuez, and also just trying to push for new music, especially from composers like, you know, storied composers like Howard Shore, you know. So what is that sort of, do you have sort of like a goal in mind? Is there some sort of greater objective that's going on? Because this seems to run through all your albums, this theme of sort of pop music, classical music, pop music, classical music, just one after the other on the same album.
Yes, because I just don't like to be limited by genre and by putting everything in different boxes. I believe that guitar lends itself to so much more music than you would think in the first place, because guitar is the world's most popular and most open instrument, and it is a connecting medium for so much of what we hear every day in our life. And yes, I have been trained as the most sort of serious classical guitarist, and that's what is the most important and the core and the essence of who I am, absolutely. But I think exposing that to a wider world and finding a way with music and pushing those boundaries whenever you can and experimenting and seeing, and sometimes you're going to succeed and sometimes you're going to fail. I mean, there are things, so far I have recorded 6-7 albums on Universal, and you're right, they have evolved from, you know, being the core Spanish repertoire to Latin repertoire to the big concertos like the Rodrigos, and then went into Beatles, and then went into more poppy stuff, and then coming back now to commissions and film composers. And probably the next one is going to be incredibly core and probably just, you know, back to the lute suites or something as pure as that.
Yeah.
And it's just because I love to challenge the perception of the guitar as something very, very versatile and something that shouldn't be bound by genres or bound by any preconceived notions of what it's supposed to be. I think that also goes hand in hand with being a classical guitarist in a wider sense of classical music in the first place, because as you know, by default, we are destined to create careers and lives within a very small community. And you know, that's a beautiful thing, but it's even more beautiful when you're able to bring the wider world into that world and expose it in this way. So I'm just always excited about crossing over without crossing over in a sense of what it means, because when we think of crossover, we think it's a dirty word and it's like sort of a compromising of quality or
yeah.
But if you cross over through different genres while using all the assets you have from your own world, then you're doing the right thing. And that's something that I've always been excited about. I think that with the Sound of Silence, with that album in particular, I think I love the process of doing that because I was really pushing my boundaries there. I didn't know I was going to go that far, and I just allowed that process to take me as far as it did. But I think that's probably as far as I will ever go, because I felt that there were moments and pieces on that album that, kind of were such experiments, you know, and it's right. And it's very important to experiment, but it's also important to know when enough is enough. And I'm very, very happy for that experience, because if I haven't done it, I wouldn't have known. So it's funny, when I listen to that album, it's probably the only album that I find able to listen to myself, because
wow.
it feels so different. That and the Beatles album, because they are so different to what I normally do, and it excites me to hear myself in a context that requires a completely different production, a different process, and a different sound.
How do you convince? I mean, this is the Sound of Silence record is on Decca, and you convinced them to to let you record, you know, Paul Simon, Tauriga, you know, that Men Will Defy, then you're, you know, all of a sudden you're playing in the Sweet Del Recuerdo by Marilyn. And then all of a sudden Leonard Cohen, and then back to Tauriga, and then Brower. It's pretty outstanding. I would imagine that this would be something that you could just do on a private label. But you're doing this on these. You're doing it on Deutsche Grammophon.
On a major.
Doing it on the biggest labels in the classical world. And do you ever kind of hit a wall with some of these people where they're just like, dude, we really just want you to play the Aranjuez, and we really just want you to play Alhambra again? Do you get sort of some back and forths, or do you have a pretty good representative that sort of goes up to bat for you in these situations?
Oh, I have such a beautiful relationship with everyone I work with. And that's something that is so important to me, because I think a recording artist's career is a collaborative career with all these people. And I think we are all an equal part of it. And you know, the market today dictates for much more variety, and actually it's the opposite of what you're asking, because the Aranjuez and the standard repertoire has been recorded hundreds of times. So if your version is the best that's ever been there, it's still not good enough for it to make any sense in terms of commerciality of it, in terms of what the outreach that it has. But if you come up with ideas that are new, and all this music is it's it's arranged from scratch. It's actually 10 times harder to record an album like The Beatles or The Sound of Silence than it is to record an album of standard repertoire, because you're starting from zero and you have to make sense of it within the context of your own art. It's a hugely labor-intensive process where everyone needs to be on board. And I have to tell you, Decca has been always thrilled when I went into the excursions into the repertoire, you know, the sort of left side popular repertoire, because it is much more playlistable and much more accessible for the 21st century. This conversation is something I always enjoy, because it's different perspectives and different starting points, but in the end, the goals are the same. And that's true for any successful collaborative relationship.
You said that, you know, at the end of this, I mean, coming out of The Moon in the Forest, is it The Moon in the Forest? That's the name of the album, not The Man in the Forest.
The Moon, as in Dark Moon. So we took the analogy from the first concerto, and then The Forest as the Howard Shore's concerto.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine that coming off of, you know, the Beatles album and then the Sound of Silence album, and then coming out of this, you probably are inspired at this point to go back to, you said, just rep that is, you know, some solo rep. Not necessarily standard rep per se, but something that was written for the guitar by a skilled guitar composer. You know, by nature.
Yes, of course. I mean, a skilled guitar composer. That's a hard thing to kind of define, because I feel that some of the best guitar pieces were written by non-guitarists.
Well, for example, Rodrigo
wasn't a guitarist himself either. You know, so it's interesting.
I think it is interesting in the sense that, you know, we don't think about that. We just sort of assume, oh, well, Rodrigo was a guitarist, and, you know, he sat there playing the guitar and came up with all this stuff in the same way that Tarraga did.
He didn't. that explains a lot of impossible chords and a lot of very difficult notes.
Everything really high up. So that's sort of where you think your next move is going to be. I know that you've sort of toyed with arranging. Have you ever done a lot with composition on your own?
No, I don't think I have that bone in my body. I don't think that I'm a composer by nature. I think that my strength is to, when I take a piece of music, make it sound authentic and unique. But I don't think I'm good at writing my own music. When it comes to arranging, you are sort of part composing, because you are creating transcriptions and you are taking a lot of liberties in making it as good as you think it can be. So that, in a sense, is as close as I go to composing. But to compose a piece of music from scratch, I don't think I would be able to do that. It's just not in my DNA somehow.
Well, you certainly do have something in your DNA, because the way that you're, exactly what you said, take for example on the Canción album from 2013, The Girl from Ipanema. Now, you know, we go into that thinking, here's a guitarist playing Girl from Ipanema, but you're adding harmonies and you're adding non-chord.
That was Sergio.
That was arranged by Sergio.
The arrangement. Okay. Yeah, and we worked very closely, as always, Sergio and I. Sergio arranged all the Beatles tracks as well with me, and I just love that process, because we are creating when we are doing that. We are creating new music out of something that is so universally known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's a great process.
So when you're working with Sergio, where are you working with him? Are you working with him in where do you live now? Actually, what's your country of residence?
Oh. I'm a Londoner. I've been a Londoner for 22 years. And that's where I live and that's where I'm based. And it's a great spot, because from London, everything is so close.
Yeah.
I always think that London and New York are the only really global cities in this world that sort of exist as their own universe. Yeah. But within the two, what's nice with London is that London is much more relaxed and much more chill than New York, because it's just bigger and wider and there's more space. And we tend to live in parts of town which look more like villages, and yet they are just a few miles from Trafalgar Square. So it's a great place. I'm very, very happy living in London. But when I'm working with Sergio, we're working remotely. I mean, we're using the technology to experiment and to work on the ideas. And he's a phenomenal guy. I love Sergio. I think he's just an absolute legend.
Yeah, he's one of those guys that if I'm a composer and I will just sort of write him with something, because I've met him a couple of times, and most people don't get back to me, you know. Most people who I didn't study with or who I don't know personally from New York. But, you know, I'll come out with something and I'll be like, hey, you know, give this a look. But he poured over it and gave me notes on everything.
Yeah.
And he didn't.
Yeah, no, he's the best.
That's unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, it's such a rare thing in our industry to have that sort of a personality, a guy who is that high up, who is still accessible and considers himself part of every smaller guitar community out there. So,
and that's why he's great. That's why he's great, because I think that the greater you are, the more humility you need to have. Because
I think so too. Yeah.
In the end, what do you have left? What you have left in the end is true and honest experiences. And I think that in life, we just have to not take ourselves too seriously. We just have to go with the flow and do our best. And if we've done our best, that's all that matters. And everything else around you is just noise and it's just completely unimportant.
That is 100%. That's how I've gotten through this life. So as far as, and I think you kind of probably had to learn that early on. You know, I was reading about you and your time as a child in Montenegro was during the war down in that area. Talk to me about that. I understand that you actually wrote to the Royal Academy of Music and asked to get in. But while that was going on, there was actually a lot of international turmoil happening. It must have been kind of frightening to be in that area at that time, at that age.
Well, it was. But at the same time, when you are growing up there and when you are from there, you don't know any difference. So you just kind of go with the flow again and whatever life throws at you, metaphorically or literally. But it's a... the gift really here for me was that I discovered guitar and that I discovered music and I discovered firsthand what the power of music truly is. And that is that it gives you this amazing ability that no matter what goes on in the world, the moment you play your instrument or you play it for others, you are creating your own world and it can be as beautiful or as wonderful as you want it to be. And that was incredibly meaningful to me in those years, and that's why I passionately took to the guitar and practiced and worked and got good at it. And that's why I was lucky to have the doors of the world open for me, and so that today I have the life and the career that is an absolute dream, and it's something I never take for granted, exactly because... it came to me. It was given to me as a sort of a gift, and it's mine to make sure that I honor that at all times. So that process of growing up, I feel, even though compared to a lot of people in the Balkans, you know, who were really in the war, who were in Montenegro, it was terrible, but at least you know we didn't have the things we are seeing now on TV happening in Ukraine, which is just, I mean, that just brings all those horrible memories.
I would have thought that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really, really disturbing for me. And I find it so impossible to accept that that's happening because I just remember it firsthand. And it's a terrible, terrible tragedy when that happens. But the world is unfair and it will always be unfair. And we just have to, you know, never lose our belief, and our belief is harder to lose when you have a guiding star. And for me, that guiding star was music,
and it still is. You know, I mean, that's the thing is,
yes, Yeah. I mean, life gets more complicated the older you get. And you know, the life's experiences get more complicated. And the more successful you are, the more responsibility you have, the more pressure you're under. And, you know, but you must never forget why you're doing it, who you are. And I try to remind myself of that every day.
Yeah, I mean, you do have a sort of a busy schedule. I mean, you know, I mean, I know that you were able to probably stay in London longer than maybe you ever had.
The pandemic was such a wonderful time, really. I mean, it was it was awful on one hand, but so wonderful artistically, because you suddenly had space, and there was space. There was just this void where you had to just be on your own, when you just had to be with your thoughts and with yourself without the pressures of deadlines, of schedules, and so on. And I loved every moment of it, except obviously, you know, if someone I loved got ill or something happened, then of course I was dead scared for them. Yeah. But I think in this kind of, as people, they call it isolation, I just loved the isolation because I was never isolated before in this way. And that I found artistically very helpful and very productive. So now that things have resumed or partly resumed, still not really quite 100% because the audiences have been still quite slow. We're catching up on concerts. It's been great. I mean, I'm in the US now for a whole month, and I've enjoyed seeing the differences between different states and different cities and different places and how they all cope with it. The New York concert is on Sunday, then I go to Toronto, and then I'm down in Florida, and then the summer is literally every other day there's a concert. So it's going to be really intense, but I really, really can't wait. I've missed it.
Yeah, I bet you have. I mean, I can imagine. Mm. And you're playing at Town Hall, right? Have you played there before?
No, I've never played there before. I'm actually really excited about it because it's a place where they traditionally organized Segovia and Williams and Bream in New York. And it's a, they say the place lends itself to the guitar because of its wonderful acoustics. And I've only been there ever once for a concert that was played by Anushka Shankar, who's a good friend of mine. And she was doing a sitar recital, which was magical. So I think I'm excited to see what that feels like, because it's not an obvious concert hall in the city at this point, but at that time it was one of the most important places. We'll see. It's an homage to Segovia because it honors that 100th anniversary of the hall, and that's where Segovia made his debut about 100 years ago. So it just all has a nice sort of connecting story to it.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's interesting. So it's 100 years ago, Segovia played, his U.S. debut was at Town Hall?
Yes. The Town Hall opened 100 years ago, and Segovia soon after played his debut in New York City. And Bream and Williams and a lot of people played in the Town Hall because apparently it was just, it had something, it was quite a place for guitar at that time. So it's just interesting history.
You know, I don't think I've ever talked about this before. I've had a lot of people on. Mm-hmm. I've never really talked about their favorite concert halls that they played in, the guitar. Yeah. And you know, if you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that, I'd love to sort of check in with you on that. I haven't had the opportunity to play in anything nearly that big at all. But I wonder, how would you rank them? Like, which one is your favorite, and which one do you find the most challenging? And sort of like, why, what about a hall makes it challenging?
I think that your performance changes completely depending on where you play. And that's a sort of a variability in the artistic process that I enjoy a lot, because I just change and the pieces change and my expression changes depending of where I am. I also find that each concert hall has its own energy, and sometimes it's really good energy and sometimes it's very bad energy. And I find that I respond to that so severely. Again, I make it part of the process. But if if I'm, you know, thinking of recital halls, which is what for the guitar is ideal, you know, halls which are about 1,000 seats, maybe max 1,200, I would say that, you know, the Wigmore Hall in London is just such a phenomenal place for the guitar. It's maybe my favorite in the whole world. The small hall of the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam is absolutely stunning. In America, there is a really beautiful concert hall in La Jolla, in outside of San Diego, for La Jolla Music, La Jolla Festival uses it. It's amazing. The Bing concert hall in Stamford is something that I've never experienced anything like it. It has this moving top that changes the acoustic depending on what the instrument it is, and it was just phenomenally focused sound and just incredible. And then in Japan, I mean, every concert hall in Japan is unbelievable. Almost every, not every, but like they just have the most phenomenal concert halls. But then often I have to play in really big halls, like the Albert Hall in London, which is 5,000 seats.
Yeah.
So I'm just doing a show there on the 1st of June. And then that becomes a completely different game, because you have to amplify the instrument. You have to light it in a focused way so that the attention of the people is on you. And but then you play differently. Your energy is different. Everything's different. It's a really exciting thing every time that there is a concert that you can just, you know, be really, you never know what's going to hit you, and you just have to make it work.
Yeah, you do. And what kind of guitar do you play?
I play a Greg Smallman, and I love his guitars from very early on. I didn't know before I was introduced to an instrument, to this instrument, that it was the guitar that John Williams was using in most of his later recordings. And John Williams was, and still is, a huge idol and an inspiration for me. I just loved the aesthetic of that sound, the sort of depth and clarity it has. And when the opportunity presented itself, I was very lucky to get one in 2007. And it's the instrument I still play. And I would never, ever want anything else. I just think that these guitars are magical. Actually, it's a funny story. When I was touring in Australia in 2012, it's now 10 years ago, wow. Mm-hmm. I got an email from him, and he said, so I want to meet you, because when I got my guitar in 2007, I didn't know him. I just wrote to him and had to have a reference so that I get an instrument in 2 years rather than 10. Mm-hmm. And he said, I didn't know you then, so I don't know what instrument I sent you, but you know, now that you are doing so well, I you need to have the best. So, I'm going to come and see you. And there he was in the hotel lobby with two new guitars. And he said, take them, play them, and take which one you like. I was so excited. Can you imagine the excitement? It's like meeting the creator, you know. And he's such a wonderful, wonderful man, so dedicated to his craft. And I remember playing these other two guitars, and I remember liking them because all his instruments are beautiful. But they just didn't have what my guitar had, and I remember telling him, I said, you know, these two guitars are beautiful, but mine is better. So I'm just going to stick with this one, but let's make a deal here. And he said, okay, tell me. So I said, when you make the guitar of your career, that's the one I want to have. So you just call me when you think you have it. And 4 years later, he called me and he said, I think I have it. So he sent it to me, and it's amazing. I mean, the instrument is like a whole orchestra. But you won't believe it. I still can't make a shift. I still can't move to the new guitar. I can't do it.
I can understand. You become attached. Yeah. It becomes your sound, you know?
Yes, For sure. And with the other guitar, I would have to almost start from scratch, I think. It's a funny thing, because this guitar I play now has been with me through everything. And my process of becoming the artist that I am has been through this guitar. So all of that is in the wood of that instrument. So it's just very interesting how...
I remember I was doing a recording, and my friend, was like, you shouldn't use I use D'Addario's, and he was like, you need to maybe just check out some other string. And I tried, and my relationship from finger to string.
Yes.
After I'm 45, I was just like, I don't want to deal with this. I can't.
I know what you mean. Yeah.
You build yourself around the guitar, and it's like any sort of little shift is a big deal, you know?
But when it comes to strings, I used to be the D'Addario person myself. And I think these are, of course, great strings. But I have to say, I've switched to Cantiga, Savarese.
Yeah.
And they really transform your instrument. I'm such a fan, because they stay fresh for longer.
That's good.
And they draw the sounds out of the instruments, which are new, but they have the same thickness and the same relationship to fingers. So I think the shift in the physical sense would not be too huge. So just try them out.
That's a good point. Yeah. Yeah, because when I was
Cantiga.
Cantiga. Yeah, if you did that shift and it wasn't such a massive difference. There's also this thing going on these days where I started using strings that weren't polished as much. Have you ran into those? They look like they've already been played for like 6 months.
I don't like that.
I don't like it either.
No, I think.
Yeah.
But a lot of guitarists squeak, like it's a curse. But I think you don't have to squeak even with new strings if you know what you're doing. So you can put that as part of your technique, not to squeak, but then the sound will be so much better. I think polished strings are a waste of money, because it's like you're buying old strings. I don't like it.
Yeah, you're buying old strings. Yeah. And it looks like it too. It makes your guitar look like it's been through the wash.
I know. I'm not a fan, I have to say. I don't like polished strings.
So we're kind of coming to the end here. Is there anything that you have coming up, or something that you'd like to share with the audience?
Well, not really. I mean, just happy to chat with another guitarist. I mean, that's always such fun. Yes, what's coming up is coming up. We're just going to go with the flow and make the most of it. I'm looking forward to. I don't know when you are planning to publish this interview, but if anyone's in the city on Sunday, it would be great to have guitarists in the audience in New York City. But I'll be coming back to the city to play at the 92nd Street Y next season.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And that will be great. A lot of USA. I'll be in the USA a lot in the next year, just doing lots of performances. So,
well, good, because we need it. We need to go out and see more stuff like this. We're hungry for it, especially people from Europe. We were away from each other for so long, and
absolutely,
now we're back.
It's very unnatural to be so disconnected. But it's just the world is a crazy place right now in so many ways.
It is. Well, thank you for sharing your music with us, Milo. Should we look forward to whatever comes next?
Thank you, and I'm so happy you like the new concertos, because that really, really means a lot to me, because it's. I really want these concertos to live beyond the recording and beyond the premiere.
I really hadn't. I kind of fallen off. I mean, I don't listen to that much classical guitar. Unless it's kind of something for the show or.
Yeah.
But so I hadn't really listened to anything from you since like maybe 2011, 2012, like my first or second album or something. And then today I like went like, oh, let's check out the latest thing. And I was just like, oh my God, this is so good. Congratulations. Such a monumental effort. And it's really going to, I think it's the future. I think that that's what's, people writing pieces of that caliber.
Yes.
For this instrument.
Exactly.
At that level is really what needs to happen before anything else happens. So I'm glad furthering it for us.
Thank you. Great. Lovely to talk to you, Brett.
Lovely to talk to you too, Milos. That does it for my time with Milos. I hope you enjoyed it. Please go to brettwilliamsmusic.com/support to donate to the show. That's brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. I need your help more than ever so that I can move out of this old lady's house. Please. Just not a big deal, right? A little bit here and there. It's not going to kill you. brettwilliamsmusic.com/support. Make sure you check out Rupert and Laura's new album, Songs of Love and Despair. No, that's right. Songs of Love and Despair. That's going to be out March 25th. Make sure you check it out. Boyd meets girl guitar and cello duo. Boyd meets girl. See you guys next time with Hannah Murphy. New guitarist Hannah Murphy is going to be on the show. Bye.